Welcome to Nonprofits. It's June 8th. My name's Atif.
My name is Scott.
So Robert's on vacation, and we were going to wait until he got back, but because we live in such an information and news-dense environment, we thought there were a few things that we wanted to talk about, mainly because, well, A, we just like talking about this stuff. Also, tonight, there are the elections in England. There are a lot of – We had the Comey testimony today. So from a forecasting perspective, I'm interested in talking a little bit about what we see as just over the last few weeks as inflection points, things that down the road we can point to stuff that's happened the last 3 weeks and say, yeah, this materially changed what I thought would happen. This is really probative in terms of some outcome down the road. And it could be some development in the United States. It could be some development in global politics. But it certainly seems that because the environment we're in, a lot of things that are happening are important, like relevant, and not just important in terms of the impact they have on our lives, but again, they're inflection points. They're things that we think will have a big impact on something important, short-term and long-term. So you were telling me a story right before we started recording.
Yeah. One of the stories that I was saying was a person that I forecast with professionally that I saw a comment that he had made where they were asking him about the election in the UK. And he said, I'm giving it a 50-50 chance that May stays in power or something like that, which was basically absurd because she had this overwhelming lead. And even right up until the day of the election, she was still predicted to win pretty easily, although she certainly had lost a lot of ground. But he basically said, I'm giving everything in forecasting a 50-50 chance now, because basically since 2016, probabilities have broken.
Yes.
Until they reset, I'm at 50-50.
Yep.
But in the UK election, it appears that May still had, or Conservatives, which is the party of May, the current prime minister, they probably will not have a majority. There may be a minority coalition. There's all sorts of complexities to this, but basically she lost a whole lot of ground that was not expected even up until the last day.
Right. And this is self-inflicted. She called for this election because she thought she was playing a strong hand and they could fortify their position.
Which is what happens in parliamentary democracies. Basically, the prime minister at any point can say, I'm going to call for a new election. And that can, if they win, it extends their term. It gives them more power because they can fill out the rest of this long term if they don't get some big vote of no confidence. But if they mess up, which seems to be often the case, it goes horribly wrong.
Yes.
And then I was watching CNN in the middle of this and I saw, I don't know if it was their political analyst or political strategist, but the person's name was literally Crystal with a K, Crystal Ball.
Yes, your television is talking to you.
Yeah, I was like, why are we trying to do educated forecasting? Crystal Ball's on TV. I'm just going to listen to her.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I had a friend come into my office this week and say, I think we're living in the Matrix. Have you seen the name of the leaker? And there was a recent leak from a young woman who had top secret security clearance, and she was leaking information about the Russia investigation and just the level to which they had penetrated. I think it was voting machine manufacturers, and I also think state elections. And apparently it was much deeper than had been previously thought. But her name is Reality Winner. And he took this as a sign that something is trying to communicate with us, that we are in a matrix, and the names and the things we are seeing now are saying, this is not real, you need to wake up. I feel like there's something to that.
But there's also this sort of post-hippie generation, but they were named by their parents issue.
Like Moon's out. Moon Unit. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. It's hard to say for sure. But yeah, it's interesting. So with the Comey testimony was today. Well, first, what were your thoughts on the Comey testimony?
I was surprised at how open Comey was to state a lot of ideas, like, for instance, saying simply that his opinions. So when he was the FBI director and he was talking before Congress, he was very, very careful to only say, I would say, facts. And even with the facts, to be very, very careful. Now that, and this was the, let's see, what's the opposite of a genius? I don't want to use any words here. The stupidity of firing him. Was it now basically he's more or less free to talk? And I think he is mad. In the sense of angry, not mad in the sense of crazy. And so I was surprised that he would say things like, I was taking notes. I was taking notes because I was afraid that the president would lie. I didn't want to be in the same room as him by myself because I thought he would lie. I'm just paraphrasing, so I don't have this exactly accurate.
No, yeah, he used the term lie.
Yeah, he said lie. Yeah, lie, lie, lie. And in English, as all the people in America know, this is a word we like never use. We try to, you know, say it's a very impolite word, you know, use.
We have a lot of euphemisms for
lie. Yeah, exactly. And so to just say lie, this is like, oh my God. Even though with Trump, it's clear. And yet in a press conference today, his press secretary, or I shouldn't say his press secretary, it's not actually his official press secretary now, but it appears Huckabee is his.
No, but the permanent acting.
The permanent stand-in.
Right.
Yeah. And he was saying, you know, the president is not a liar. And people are commenting, this is the same as like Nixon saying, I am not a thief. Like this, yeah. If you have to say it, there's something wrong. But that Comey had said that this was the first time in his career where he felt the need to be taking notes, where he felt, you know, these sort of fears that this, you know, that whatever he did, he needed to write notes the moment he got out of the meeting. So literally when he would get out of a meeting with Trump, he would immediately go out to his Suburban or whatever he's being driven around in, sit at his, you know, legal computer and type out, you know, more or less verbatim what he had just heard, what he just heard and yes. said. And he said he never felt the need to do that with George W. Bush. He never felt the need to do that with Obama. And, you know, I think we all have our own political ideologies. I have presidents I preferred or not preferred. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty clear where my biases lie. But seriously, even with Bush, I didn't really have the feeling that, okay, this guy, you don't, his word doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. It's remarkable. So one of the things that has struck me, and it'll be interesting to see how we think this administration vis-a-vis a variety of parties, including the public, including the Democrats and Republicans, including foreign governments, changes following this testimony. But it's interesting to me to see the various ways people on the right try to spin these circumstances. There is the Sarah Huckabee perspective, which was, and Trump's personal attorney perspective, which was, he is lying and Trump is telling the truth. And now there are some Democratic senators who say, oh, let's get Trump under oath. I mean, Comey came out and testified under oath. Let's get Trump under oath and let's sort this out. That was sort of the administration's position. A lot of people in Congress who were trying to play it down, who were saying, well, if this happened, this didn't rise to the level of obstruction of justice. And then you had the it's sad to me. And I try not to judge. Like, I have opinions, but I try to look at this from kind of a dispassionate kind of impersonal perspective. And I can dislike behaviors because I think they're dishonest. I think honesty is a critical component of good forecasting and good decision-making, as opposed to I dislike this person because they're dishonest. But it's remarkable to me to see the way the office of the presidency, I think this is one of the most disappointing things of the last few months, has been defined now. Like it's reached the point now where, as opposed to the presidency being this noble position where someone is defending all these ideals, and I think Comey used the term the city on a hill, the shining city on the hill, as opposed to the president being this person who defends these Western values and defends the United States as this exceptional nation, now it seems like the standard is just, can this person sign a bill? Like, if this person can sign a bill, we are fine with this person being president. And we saw, like, the two quotes that I saw recently over the last day or two, which I found remarkable. One was Chris Christie, who, when Comey's prepared remarks were released ahead of his testimony, said, because Comey said that Trump had asked him, you know, for his loyalty directly. Are you loyal? Can you be loyal to me? And Chris Christie said, well, that's just how people talk in New York. Like, this is just how Trump talks. And Paul Ryan did a similar line today where he said, Trump doesn't know any better. Trump is a businessman. He doesn't know the way of government. He doesn't know that's inappropriate. Those are remarkable arguments to me. And those arguments are, what do you expect? Look.
Is this calculated at all? Like, they know that he's not popular in New York. They know that New York is not popular in the core area of Trump's support. And so basically, we'll just blame it as he's a good guy, but he got stuck growing up in New York. Therefore, this is just his craziness. He can't sort of get out of his skin. He can't wash it off. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, but not
even
his craziness. This is him being real.
Yeah.
This is how real he is compared to the elites. And this gets to, so a couple of things that have happened over the last few weeks, because we haven't talked about them. One is, well, this is a minor thing, but the New York Times ran a letter from a, it's weird because it was just sort of a standalone letter from a Trump supporter who said, "We Trump supporters love how you guys tie yourselves in knots over Trump. We root for him. It makes me happy every time I wake up and see people in the news or, you know, listen to NPR and hear people get mad at Trump. Like, I love it. This is what I elected Trump to do, to be a thorn in your side." And there was there's a Charlie Sykes op-ed. Charlie Sykes used to be a conservative radio host in Wisconsin who was sort of a never-Trumper and who became very disillusioned with the Republican Party after he realized as soon as he started to attack Trump's positions, people that he thought were reasonable, loyal supporters turned on him, just turned on him in a flash. And he realized that they'd sort of hollowed out the Republican Party with this right-wing media machine and now would train people to accept almost any argument. And one of the stories, and this is your neck of the woods, because you were raised in Oregon or Washington State?
Oregon.
Yeah. So in Portland, Oregon, there was a stabbing. And
this is way too close to home for me.
Yeah. It's
in multiple levels. So, yeah.
No, I mean, if you talk about it, but I think one of the things the guy said was maybe this is after he was arrested, but he just talked about how liberals deserve this. This is what liberals get. There have been a few attacks that haven't been race-based. They haven't been, sort of gender or ethnicity. They have been liberal/Democrat-based. And that, to me, is alarming. Like, this was a fusion of two girls, one of them was wearing a scarf, and an attack on liberals.
The other one was black.
Yeah.
And the attacker just assumed they're both from Saudi Arabia. And one of the things I was going to say why I said this is way too close to home is I rarely ever take public transportation living in the bubble that I do, which means I, you know, grew up driving a truck. Mm-hmm. But you know, basically, I've been on that line. And when I go to Portland, that's near an area. Every time I go to America, I go to Portland, and that's near, it's in an area I'm in. But also, one of the people who died is from Ashland, which is about 15 minutes from my home. And I used to bicycle to where he lived. And it's basically a town that has a Shakespeare Festival, kind of a bit of a hippie community, but now very, very upscale hippie community. Mm-hmm. And so one of the guys who died, his first name was Taliesin, which is the name of Frank Lloyd Wright's, I think, community that he developed. But basically this guy who died, his mom is incredibly kind person, very politically active, who had been sending geodesic domes, I think it was, to support the people at Standing Rock in North Dakota who were protesting the pipelines.
This is the Reed student?
Yeah, this is the Reed student. And then there's also an amazing photo, I think it was 4 days after the stabbing, where there was some rally in Portland in support of both the people who defended the girls against the attacker. But the mother was there, and there's this very, very powerful photo of her with her hands around the head, looking into the face of a Muslim woman, but with like a picture of like, basically like a pure joy, a pure love and joy. You know, it's like,
right,
humanity. It's just a great, you know, view of humanity, as opposed to, oh yeah, you guys chose to wear the scarf and that got my son killed. If you had just dressed like everybody else, we'd have had no problem. That wasn't the view at all. And so it's stunning. And the people who defended, what was a great thing, I mean, okay, it's a horrible event that these people died. It's horrible that there was somebody who is so...
Oh, hold on, because it just occurs to me. We know this story.
Okay, sure.
I'm not sure if you listen.
Okay, so I can do a brief scenario. So there's a light rail system in Portland, so train. And I believe that's it. I don't think it was a bus. And anyway, some man who is so racist and hateful that the alt-right, who were holding sort of a, I know they would say freedom of speech rally, but something in the past, within the last year, they didn't want him in. It's like, this guy is too crazy for them. He was walking there with a baseball bat. The police took the baseball bat away. The police, he's been arrested before. I think he had a felony, but I'm not sure about that. But he was going with one of the, I can't remember what you call it, the flag, like the original flag of the United States, so the 13 stars flag, and chain around his neck, like chains wrapped around. He is, you know, he's mentally unstable, but then I would say so are most terrorists, whether they're, you know, Islamic or Christian or whatever the base background is.
Yeah.
But regardless, this guy, you know, gets on this train and starts screaming at these two girls all sorts of, you know, racist, hateful things. Go back to your country. Go back to Saudi Arabia, which they, by the way, were not from. And three people on the train stood in between him and the girls to basically defend them. you know, and basically be like, you know, hey, you don't do that. And
apparently he was becoming threatened. Yeah, yeah. I think at some point they stood up to leave and he said something like, try something or do something.
Yeah. And these guys got in between him, and it was amazing cross section of America, as opposed to people who
it really was.
Right. This is wonderful. I mean, it's not wonderful that they died, but we have, you know, this right, left, you're a Trump supporter, you're not a Trump supporter, whatever. In this case, one of the guys who died, I think, was a 53-year-old Navy veteran, or I may have wrong, but he was a military veteran who had actually run for, I think, something like county council recently because he thought, you know, he should help society in his way. Another guy was 23, who was a Reed student. You may not know what Reed is, but Reed is a university Reed College is a college in Portland. That's one of the hardest colleges to get into in the United States, but it's also very, very liberal. It's extremely liberal. It probably makes you know, Berkeley look conservative. And but it's a serious school. And so he had just graduated.
Yeah, it's very competitive, yeah. And also very left-wing.
Yeah, extremely left-wing. And so one of the guys who was also defending was from Reed. So you have, you know, sort of, let's say, ideological opposites there, but they both felt there was a need to step in and protect people being attacked, you know, for no reason. And then right. There's a third guy who got injured, who I believe
was a poet.
Exactly, poet. So you have these, you know, very different people, but all stepping in to do their part. When the guy was dying on the bus, the guy from Reed, he was like, his last statements were basically to let everybody on the bus know that he loved them. You know, it's such a beautiful
exactly. Moment.
And then when I saw the picture of his mom, you know, 4 days later, it was also like this, just sort of, you know, I'm sure she's sad, but it was really full of love. And mm-hmm. I thought, you know, that's the good takeaway from this. And basically what we should be trying to achieve, you know, like, regardless of what you're, I mean, and I know this show is supposed to be about forecasting, not about touchy-feely, let's all be happy. But sure. But seriously, it's like, you know, why can't we have differing opinions, deal with some, even different facts if we want, but at least, you know, keep things civil.
Right. No, and that to me, yes. And the reason I brought that up, and you're exactly right with the sentiments, I think with your description of it, is because there's an approach to these situations where you sort of see it as it is, and you try and not necessarily have an emotional response to it, but you don't sort of sanitize it and dehumanize things and people and sort of take things out of context. And it felt to me the reaction to the sort of pre-reaction to the Comey testimony and then the reaction after the Comey testimony really tried to, it's almost like a semantic satiation where you say a word over and over again until it loses meaning. It really tried to confuse people, like, in a very sinister way. Sort of, and I almost, watching McCain's testimony at the end, where he just looked like he was confused, and he sounded like he was confused. And he blamed it after, he said, you know, after saw the response, he was like, oh, I was up late watching the Arizona Diamondbacks or something. But it felt as if he was trying to remember an argument he wanted to make to kind of muddy the waters. We would compare the investigation to Trump, to the investigation Hillary's emails, which is, and Comey seemed confused because he pointed out these are two different things. Are you trying to suggest that Hillary also collaborated with the Russians so she'd lose the election? Like, it's, his point wasn't clear, but it felt as if it was of a kind with a lot of these other attempts to strip meaning from what was happening and to generate a lot of chaff.
Right.
And there's a recent comment in an interview with Eric Trump on a Sean Hannity show where he said something to the effect of, oh, he was angry at Democrats. He said, they're very hate filled. I don't even think of them as people. And that kind of line, got picked up because a lot of people find it, that kind of dehumanization.
Basket of deplorables.
Yeah, exactly. Even calling someone deplorable, at least, is saying you're a deplorable human being.
You're human.
Yeah, but that's the kind of dehumanization that to me is of a kind with, I'm going to stab these people on this train because they're liberals and liberals are less than human. Like, liberals are enemies.
Right.
And it reminded me of the, there's a television show. I know you guys watch Smiley and the Smiley Hour. We have a lot of different television you guys. I don't know if there's a Smiley Hour, by the way, but I hope there is. But there's a television show in the United States called The Leftovers. It's a good show. It's an interesting premise. It's kind of complicated, but there was a recent episode where they mentioned something called the Fisher scenario or the Fisher protocols. And it was mentioned in an issue of our old friend, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists from the 80s. And it's this sort of a hypothetical scenario to deter a nuclear strike. And the idea is that instead of making, there's this idea that someone engaged in, like if you have a president, if you have members of the military who think about nuclear strike, there are a lot of code words and there are a lot of different ways to make the whole process abstract and to push them away from the fact that they're talking about launching missiles that will can wipe out tens of thousands of people in a flash. And so the idea was there would be a young person, a naval officer, something like that, who would have the key that the president needs to use to launch the missiles surgically implanted under his heart or somewhere in his chest. And he would walk around with a big butcher knife. And if the president ever wanted to fire the nuclear weapon, the only way he could do it would be to have to kill this person with his own hands and extract the key. And when the quote is, when he suggested this to a friend of the Pentagon, they said, "My God, that's terrible. Having to kill someone would distort the president's judgment. He might never push the button." It seems to me, watching these defenses of the Trump administration, that they're real attempts to denude things that normally have a lot of meaning of their meaning, and to play around with how we normally perceive events and how we normally weigh and value events to I think our society's detriment. And so this week, and the Comey testimony in particular, in the defense of the Comey testimony, seems to me to be an inflection point. Like, how we respond over the next few days to this as a society, I think will affect how I forecast political events in the future. Because if everyone's response on the right is to minimize all of this and to focus on, you know, Comey mentioned at one point that he had leaked a document to a professor at a Columbia Law School. If that's the focus on the right, as opposed to all this other evidence saying there's something very bad going on in the Trump administration, or there was something very bad going on during the campaign, I think how I forecast how people are going to respond to Trump is going to differ. And it feels to me that this week is really going to inform my opinion.
It's pivotal.
Yeah. Either we're going to look at these. Yeah. I'd like to get your opinion on this, because I watched the hearing. I actually thought, barring one or two members of the Senate, that the Senate committee, both sides, actually tried to do a pretty good job of being reasonable. Now, there was a certain amount of, not to say grandstanding, but certainly they each took a position to the right and the left. But I did not get the sense that there was a lot of that kind of nonsensical posturing, with the exception of John McCain, during the testimony. I don't know if that's going to stay. I know the House actually requested that Comey testify before them, and he declined. I think the House would have been much more positional and partisan, but
they'd have just been asking about the Republicans in the House have basically been trying to make the whole thing about leaks.
It would have been leaks.
And I would say that should be a separate investigation, sure. But that just seems like a deflection in this case.
So what did you think? Like, do you see this as being a pivotal week, or do you think this is sort of a kind and it doesn't really inform?
I've seen before Comey's testimony in the last week or week and a half, he's dropped, I think, at least 12 points in the polls in terms of his unfavorability rating, people who disapprove of him. And it's now, or I should say, his approval rate, the last poll I saw was he was at 34%, and he had been at, I don't know, was it 46 or something like that. And it just took this precipitous drop. And even 36, you might say, well, that's not so bad. But basically, presidents in their first several months in office, first 6 months in office, in general, are given a lot of latitude.
Right.
Clinton was an exception. Actually, Bill Clinton had a time where he was down to, I think, 38 or something, but Trump seems to have dropped below that. And I was trying to figure out, okay, in the last couple of weeks before the Comey testimony, what was it that made his, you know, numbers go even further down? Normally, foreign policy, you know, foreign trips are a pretty easy thing,
right.
But it appears that he pretty well botched it. I mean, there's certainly people who, even after his foreign trip, would say, oh, it was good because he stood up to NATO. We need him to stand up to NATO. Even people that are somewhat on the left and I would consider reasonable people say, okay, the NATO relationship had issues. It has problems. Other countries need to step up to the plate more, but he's doing it in, you know, really a bull in the China closet method.
Right.
There were the attacks in London where basically a truck tried to run over some people, and then guys jumped out and started trying to stab people until they were stopped by a soccer fan who got mad and
the line of London
back.
Bridge. Yes, this is a good story.
Right. he just started shouting profanities at them and beating them, chasing them out of a bar or restaurant or whatever, and then following him down the road while he's getting stabbed.
So, very briefly. Yes. So, for those who don't know, there were the attacks in London. people were hit by these vehicles, and then three people, attackers came out
with
knives. And there was a guy, he was a soccer fan, and I can't remember the name of his club, but apparently it's a club that's associated. It's a soccer hooligan club.
Millwall or something like
something this, like that. I think, and he said, I think his quote was something to the effect of, and his stand, and he was stabbed all over.
He said, I am Millwall.
He said, fuck you, I'm Millwall. So apparently they came in. His quote was, they came in and they were all Islam. And I said,
and he's like, Millwall.
Yes. So they call him the Lion of London Bridge.
I'm the Packers.
It's such a good story. I think he said he had 4 to 5 pints of beer, which he said was a light night because I think he was drinking with an elderly person. And then three terrorists came in and he held them off and was stabbed a lot and survived. And his stand let other people escape. It's a good story. It's a very good story.
There was also a Romanian that was beating on him with, I don't know, frying pans or some sort of pans. And so normally Romanians don't necessarily have the best view in England, but that was a guy who stood his ground also.
Awesome.
And I shouldn't use the word stand their ground because there's stand your ground laws in Florida, and I'm not talking about that.
And Missouri. Missouri has gone down that route as well. Yeah.
So they're standing their ground with their fists against guys with knives and with pots and pans. Yeah. So truly impressive. But basically after all of this happened, the mayor, for those who don't follow these things, the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, who is Muslim, who I think was his family origin is Pakistani.
I'm not sure.
But regardless, he's widely respected there. And Trump basically came out criticizing Sadiq Khan. And Sadiq Khan had made a comment basically about there's a large police and military presence on the streets, and he's telling the people in London not to be concerned about the large presence of basically police and military with guns. This is everything will go on. And Trump tweeted basically, I don't have these the words correctly, but basically, what's wrong with him? Don't worry, that doesn't make any sense.
Context.
Yeah, and then continue to in his usual style to keep attacking Sadiq. And this would be like, they were saying, this wasn't quite a 9/11 issue, but it was still a serious attack. And imagine if after the 9/11 attack, in the first days after that, our allies, that Tony Blair or I don't even remember who was chancellor in Germany at that time, but are like, oh, we don't like the t-shirt you wore. Why were you wearing that when you stood on the, on the stand? Just start criticizing the people. It's like, these are our allies.
Yeah.
This really doesn't make sense.
Or like, why Rudy Giuliani, he married his first cousin. What, this incestuous marriage? It's like, wait, what are you talking about?
Yeah. It's just, non sequitur, but it's just crazy. But he's like using every opportunity to score political points. Trump did not quickly respond to the attack in Portland, and he could have even skipped the white supremacist part about it, because part of it is there's a body of evidence that says that we are having the rise in hate crimes has gone up precipitously in the last year.
Yes.
And I don't know, let's see, who would know what the correlation to that is, but
who can say.
Yeah, and on an individual case, it may be hard to say, but on a large group of them, you could say there's a reason.
An emboldening.
Yeah, but he didn't. But even just to say, okay, there were three heroes. I mean, normally, like when there was the attack on the train going from Belgium to France, and three American off-duty soldiers fought the attacker off. The attacker had an AK-47. They beat him. They became heroes of France. They became, I would say, heroes in America.
Yeah.
And in this case, these people should also be heroes if we're going to use the same standard.
Sure.
And it was just like, it took him a couple of days to respond, and then it's like, oh yeah, that was good. And so, and not even on his official, I think it was through his official Twitter, not through the Donald J. Trump.
Right. So it was a staffer tweeting, essentially.
Right. Yeah. And so basically, in terms of forecasting, I've reached a point where I don't look at press briefings, at the White House press briefings. I've almost completely stopped viewing them. I mean, sometimes they're good for comic relief.
It's propaganda. It feels like propaganda at this point.
Yeah, I get more. There are more facts out of RT, out of Russian television, than that. Seriously.
Yeah.
I mean, in the past, when we forecast different issues around the world, we look at the credibility of each source, and if it's something to do with Russia or Iran, Russia has RT, also Sputnik. Iran has Press TV. I would still look at those sources because I know a lot of times they really are propaganda, but there would still be kernels of truth through them. So I think it's like, okay, they may put out And I haven't done any study, but maybe let's say if 60% of their articles are true, then it's enough to say, oh, it could be. But with a lot of the press briefings right now, or with what comes out of Trump's mouth, so little of it's true that it's like, why bother, other than to just think, okay, maybe this is having an influence on the way that his core supporters believe. So I may need to read his words just to know what's happening for the, I don't know if it's 30% or the diehard fans, I'm not sure. But other than that, his words have become nearly irrelevant to me, which is very, very strange.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's, well, it's not strange. I mean, it makes sense. We are, and this is what liberal or conservative people who are critical thinkers and who are interested in using facts to inform their opinions. That's the dangerousness of this presidency. And it's not just that there is a lot of false information that's coming out. It's that as the Republican Party has closed ranks, they've really, at least in my opinion, de-emphasized critical thinking. Like they are asking their people, asking their supporters to accept things that are patently false to remain in power. And that to me is very, very dangerous. And it's, you know,
I was talking with you a couple of days ago and we had some technical difficulties and didn't go ahead and record.
Yeah, we're on my phone right now.
But it's working. But basically when we had a non-recorded conversation and one of the comments I made was, well, it doesn't seem like a whole lot's happened in the last week in the U.S. And part of the reason I was saying that was because there had been the attacks in London and, you know, these things that were major, but I hadn't heard a lot coming out. There was not a huge amount of information or sort of chaos in the U.S. compared to normal, I thought. But then I started thinking, well, actually there are, but we've become so, you know, numbed to or desensitized
right.
yep. to sort of daily events. And one of the, this may seem like a minor issue, but there was a comment that in a normal administration, I think would have been pretty devastating. And that was that on Monday, you have the attorney general and then you have U.S. attorneys. Is this correct? The top level mm-hmm. of prosecuting attorneys.
Right.
And so a large number of the U.S. attorneys had resigned during the Trump administration and he fired many of the others. Are there any left at this stage?
No, I don't believe so. I think they are still filling the positions.
I think they're all gone. So what's all we have?
So they're kind of acting lower level attorneys in those positions.
Right, right. And so this was coming out that, wow, this hasn't been filled. We have basically no U.S. attorneys. We have the attorney general who has to recuse himself from the major investigation. So we have an acting attorney general. At the U.S. attorneys level, we don't have any at all. And I know
there's no permanent leadership.
There's no permanent, right. And there's, I think, a push away from government at all, because obviously there's some people who don't like government at all, who probably don't like being sued, who have been sued. But mm-hmm. regardless, Trump tweeted something to the effect of Democratic obstructionists, they won't approve whatever. I can't get things through. This is just Democrats, you know, blocking.
Right.
They can't block when he hasn't nominated anybody.
Right.
This was absurd. It's like saying, oh, they're holding up my Supreme Court nominee. But you haven't appointed one yet. You haven't nominated one, but they're holding him up. You know, it's just so this is not even being loose with logic, not being sort of technically correct. This is just patent falsehoods. And I think in any other administration, even in George W. Bush, this sort of information was never, ever coming out. And if that had, people would be like, yeah, did he have a stroke?
Yeah, we had that discussion and I think we both realized we've just become desensitized to it, because there are other, like, he had a signing ceremony for something that wasn't actually, had no force of law. It was just, he was essentially signing a memo he was going to send to Congress, but he had a ceremony to make it look like he was signing legislation. It was in terms of, his tax law. He has been saying repeatedly that his major tax legislation is working its way through Congress and moving through Congress. There's nothing. There's no bill. Like, nothing is moving through Congress. Yeah. There is a 1 to 2 page kind of statement of, this is what I would like to see in a major tax overhaul, but there's no legislation. But he continues to refer to it when he makes statements as if, yeah, there's something happening and we're making progress. And it's that kind of puffery would make sense. It makes sense, I guess, in business. And we're now seeing, you know, one of the stories that's gone on the radar is the state of Kansas for our international listeners. One of the advantages of our federal system is we have states that will just do kind of wild stuff. And then other states can look at it and say, yeah, I'll do that, or that's not for me. And the state of Kansas, which is a Midwestern conservative state, said about 8 years ago, we are going to do all the conservative economic theory, all the supply side theory, all of it. We're going to do it. We're going to prove conservative principles work, and all the other states, and we're going to have this crazy business growth. All the other states are going to look at us and they're going to say, yeah, conservatism works. This is what we want. Crashed and burned. It turns out you need to, if you don't have tax revenue, you can't pay for government services. They've been running these huge deficits. And recently, the Republicans in the state legislature in Kansas overrode a veto from their governor that was intended to stop a tax hike. So they, Republicans in Kansas, raised taxes because they realized cutting taxes really, really low did not lead to this crazy, mystical growth in economic activity. The conservatives always say what actually happened was they ran out of money because they did not have any tax. They didn't have tax revenue. I wonder if we're reaching a point where there's going to be, whether the United States is going to be isolated because of the approach we have with Trump. And we saw that when, you know, the Paris Accord, which we haven't talked about, it seems like every other country in the world was like,
that's right. And then there was that.
Yeah. Every other country in the world seems to be like, look, if you're okay, fine. We will turn elsewhere. Macron.
That's not true. There were two other countries that didn't sign
Syria and Nicaragua.
Syria, because they were in civil war.
Nicaragua said, this needs to be tighter. Like, we're not going to sign this because we think it's too weak.
Right.
Yeah. So looking at some election results now in the UK, it looks like Theresa May is doing very poorly. And UKIP also is here's a headline from The Independent. UKIP vote.
And UKIP is basically ultra-nationalist.
Yes, right. Nigel Farage. UKIP vote collapses across Britain. I wonder if this is not a response to Trump. And my concern is, if we have a political system that continues to indulge Trump, that continues to apologize and make excuses for behavior that is bizarre and is not good for governing, if we really are going to lose our standing in the world.
I believe that the UK vote didn't have much to do with Trump at all. I think it has much to do with British and EU politics.
So go on. Tell me, give me your pitch.
I think your comment would probably be pretty American, Americentric. I recently met with somebody from the House of Lords, had some sort of very high level politicians over, and some didn't make it here because of the election, and then they needed to be there, including some political writers from major newspapers. And there is a real split in terms of basically the belief. So one thing is, people are frustrated in England that somebody even calls a vote because they've already had votes that they didn't want, and there have been many votes they didn't want that sort of went badly, like Brexit.
Sure.
But there's also, Theresa May ran a very, very bad campaign. And so part of it is, are you voting for or against a party or a particular person? So Labour has been viewed, Labour's gained a lot of seats, but Labour was viewed to have, their current leader, whose name is Corbyn, is, you know, you could say marginally a socialist, which is also not very popular in UK either. But the Labour Party may be more popular than their leader. And I think on the conservative side, May is wanting Brexit. A lot of people want Brexit that may be not some conservative, but so it's like, okay, do we vote for the conservatives because this will give strength to her negotiating power in Brexit?
Right.
And a lot of people wanted her to have more strength in negotiating Brexit. So there's people who really truly say, for sovereignty issues, they're tired of the EU, they're tired of not having the right of self-determination on a lot of issues. The EU, basically their governing body is not elected, it's appointed, and the EU Commission. And basically, people are this split between, okay, I have these ideologies, but then I also see these leaders, and they don't, the ideology and then my look at the leader don't match.
Right.
So I'm stuck not knowing what to do. I think, I wouldn't say that there's even been a complete turn away from nationalism, but I think the sort of rabid nationalism that UKIP and Farage stood for is pretty well dead. And I think Farage also has made himself into kind of a buffoon, you know, that for a while it was gaining traction. There's also something that migration has gone down a lot. So In 2015, I believe it was, there was the mass migration of people primarily from Syria, but from a lot of other countries. There's still a migration issue of people coming from Africa through Italy, but basically migration into Germany has radically reduced. Migration into UK has radically reduced.
A lot of their refugee migration.
Sure, yes, refugee migration. And so there have been, I think, three major attacks in the UK in the last, I don't know, it was 2 months. I mean, a very, very short period of time. There were mass. There was several. There was the bridge attack. There was the Manchester attack at the concert, and then there's another bridge attack followed by knifings. So there's three fairly significant attacks in a short period of time, and there's some back and forth on these people between having been in different countries. But essentially, there's a massive homegrown problem now with terrorism. So there's not this feeling, okay, if we just close the borders tomorrow, our country is safe. Right. And also, Theresa May, the prime minister, when she was, I believe, as home secretary, she was basically, I believe I was correct, she was voting to reduce funding for the police and security services, the police forces, which resulted in, I think, a few thousand less police out on the beat. So as much as she wants to say, yeah, I'm tough on terrorism, I'm going to keep our country safe. And she kept saying, you know, vote for me. Basically, I'm going to keep us safe. I'm going to keep us strong. I'm going to negotiate well. Yeah, but by the way, you just cut a bunch of police, or, you know, a few years ago, you were cutting funds to the police, and now we're having attacks. And one of the things they've said is there's something like 3,500 people that the security services are of significant concern. And then there's like 20,000 that they're still, you know, somewhat concerned about in terms of people that may be terrorist risks within the country.
Right.
And it takes about minimum of 20 policemen to follow one person, which sounds like a lot of people, but you have to figure that they have to follow somebody 24 hours. You have to have shifts. People don't work 7 days a week. You can't follow a person with one person. You need to have a team of people following them. And so essentially, unless there's some reason that you can throw somebody in jail or kick them out of the country, it's very, very, very labor intensive to keep somebody under surveillance. And even in the best of times, there's no way you could take 20,000 people and say, let's do surveillance on all of them. That would take, you know, 400,000 police officers. Not likely to happen. But still, symbolically, to say, yeah, she's cutting money to the police, but telling us she's going to make us safe, this doesn't add up. You know, there are a lot of areas where she was a weak candidate. So it's hard to sort of mix all these things together and say, should we take this as a referendum on Trump? Should we take this as a referendum on migration? I mean, there's so many different issues.
Sure.
That I don't think it's quite a single issue policy. Certainly Trump hasn't helped her. So I would say that, you know, she went to America, she met with Trump, she tried to appear.
Was she the first foreign leader who met with Trump?
I believe she was the first one. I'm not sure.
I think that's right, but I'm not 100% either.
I think since he was president. And right. And you could say that could be a pragmatic move, because also Merkel came over and met with Trump. But I think when Merkel came over, it was clear, yeah, I'm meeting with you, but it's not like I'm trying to be buddies. Mm-hmm. And I think she tried to show a closer relationship, and that really hasn't borne positive results.
So the Paris Accord, which we haven't talked about. Actually, what was the response in Romania?
I've had enough going on. I actually haven't had that much response, but I think the general response is that this is pretty crazy.
Sure.
You know, I think that at least among my friends, they all believe that, or all but one of them, believe that the human effects on climate change are, you know, very real, and that this doesn't make sense. I had a quite serious talk this night with a German friend who had been living here, but now is living in Liechtenstein. And, you know, he was just talking about the collapse of American leadership. The idea that for years, even though he's a proud German, he was saying that, I think of Pax Atomica, like atomic peace, but he was saying American peace, Pax Americana, that the Western world was really relying on America to provide leadership in all sorts of areas,
right,
in security. Yep. And that includes in the Middle East, through Europe, all over the place. And, you know, he's talking about, it's in one way, it's great that the rest of the world seems to have caught on that climate change really is a serious issue. The human effect on it is serious. China, I think, has even caught on to this. India has. It's global. And I mentioned that there's like, I think there's 10 states now who have basically said, we are going to continue to try to follow the Paris Accords.
States and cities
Yeah.
Have agreed to commit to those goals, and also to some of them, I think, are working with European leaders.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what I was going to say, is that that some of the European leaders are saying, we're going to basically circumvent the White House and go directly to the States because that's our only option right now. Yeah. And I have a concern from this. Is this a short term? Are these effects short term? So basically, at some point, Trump will be out, whether it's by impeachment, whether it's that he serves his term and is out, or his terms, if we have the long-term scenario, but which I doubt. But will a new president eventually come into power, and be they conservative or liberal, will they still be more or less civil and follow some norms that the U.S. position will return quite quickly? And I would give the example that during George W. Bush's administration, Europe did not have a very fond view of America. I think the whole intervention in Iraq was not viewed well. The war in Afghanistan, I think, was understood in the beginning, but eventually sort of devolved. And so U.S.'s the view of the U.S. had gone down precipitously abroad. But when Obama came in, I think people were looking for American leadership and were pretty happy that, okay, even though he made some mistakes, maybe some serious mistakes, basically we have a rational person in power. We have somebody that we can deal with. And so they were pretty much eager for America to regain its position in the European world. Now, to some Trump supporters, they would say, we don't care. We don't like Europe. We don't like, you know, and I think Europe could be viewed as elites, even though if you live in Europe, you realize that like all other countries, it's not full of just EU technocrats living in Brussels. Right. You know, it's got all sorts of its own issues. But I think a lot of Trump supporters would say, yeah, we don't care. We don't care if EU doesn't like us. We don't care if NATO countries don't care.
Yeah. So one of the things that we will talk about, we were going to talk about in this podcast, wait until Robert gets back, is models for understanding Trump. And we're going to sort of do a deep dive into it because I think both of us have been reading a lot of different pieces in a lot of different media that attempt to understand the Trump administration through a variety of lenses. And they're fascinating. And a lot of them are very different. And there are a lot of different approaches, a lot of different ways to model Trump administration that I think will be interesting. And so I'll save this for that, but I will say there is one that I think is interesting. I read something recently, and I can't remember the forum for it, that talked about anti-elitism as a motivator for Trump. And it ties into what you're saying, which is for Trump, because there are a couple. A, his speech getting out of the Paris Agreement was filled with falsehoods. I mean, I think everyone can look at it and just say there's a lot of bad data. Some stuff he cited, and the authors of the study said this is incorrect. There are some debunked studies where they just recited this information verbatim, even though it was wrong. They reached a lot of conclusions in terms of the economic effects of the agreement. They're incorrect. They ignored the fact that it's almost all voluntary. You know, none of it is binding. You can hit the target or not. That it's more important to be for this collective realization we all need to work together as opposed to the actual specific targets. But one of the things that was pointed out was there is an anti-elite strain in conservatism in general, particularly among Trump supporters, so that his rejection of technocrats, the European bureaucracy and these foreigners, and his just rejection of all of that by itself, even if it didn't make sense, was something his supporters liked. They liked the fact that he said, fuck off Europe, basically. And the underlying details, the underlying facts, the evidence, none of that stuff was relevant. It was, you elites, go away. We're America. We're going to do our own thing. And so it was a win. The fact that it made all these different world leaders and all these sort of ivory tower eggheads angry because it didn't make any sense from a sort of factual perspective was a win for him and his base.
I think there's the same thing is also happening in Europe. There is a sense of people who are against technocrats. And I see that often technocrats actually are good at their jobs in a lot of different areas. But one of the people that was over here recently from UK is, you could say, an egghead. He's an extraordinarily brilliant guy, but with a working class background, where he was raised. And he sees, even though he's now, I would say, among the elite, he sees that large companies are controlling a lot of what's happening in the world. Particularly, he was concerned about things like Monsanto, what's happening with bees. Bees are, and this is a real issue that's not talked about at all, but bees are dying out very rapidly. We're getting very few strains of them remaining, and these are sort of true global risks. And there's, you know, corporations are dominating the way governments work. To the detriment of, you know, the majority of us. And so even from a, you know, a very smart, highly educated person, there's this view, we have to, you know, the system needs shaken up. What we have here is not working. And so even if we have to shoot ourselves in the foot, kind of like if you're in the war and you shoot yourself in the foot and that gets you out of getting, you know, your head shot off, you might say that's a rational act. And I think people are starting to, some people are at that point, not just drunken, uneducated people in the sticks. Right. Not all people in the sticks are drunken, uneducated, but basically there's this view that this system is so broken, it doesn't matter what we do, it needs shaken up. Otherwise, we're going off the cliff anyway.
Yeah, no, I know people who were at least Trump sympathizers for that reason. People who just said, it all sucks, it all needs to be blown up. This is the arsonist for me.
Yeah.
And yeah, like I can, it's not a position I agree with. I think that it strikes me as kind of a juvenile approach to a problem, as opposed to saying, okay, this is going to be hard work and we're steering a ship and it's going to be slow going, and this is the Obama has, I think he is analogized government to like an ocean liner. You can't make radical changes. Change course gradually. And that's how you do it. It's just a big bureaucracy. But yeah, I get why people would say, I would rather just blow up this boat and see what happens, even though we know what happens. You drown.
Because I think those people feel, and maybe rightfully so, that they're never allowed to get close to the controls.
Yes, correct.
So if I can't even get close to the controls, then what can I do?
Correct.
But I could, if I put a hole in the bottom of it, we can sink this boat and then we can start swimming and all, you know, reform a new group.
Yep.
And no, they're willing to do that.
That's And that's one of the, I think, sort of sadder elements. There's a book that's coming out. It might be called Dream Hoarders. I think it ties in with a lot of other kind of socioeconomic research. Malcolm Gladwell talked about this. A lot of people talked about it. But it's this idea that the upper, I think they say about 20% of the United States, there's a sort of top tier of educated people who have a combined income of 120, 150,000 plus. Who have managed to change all of the rules are essentially oriented to help them and to keep their group in power to make certain that their kids have access to the best resources. And this ties in obviously with economic mobility, but in general, this sense that if you are not part of this group, if you don't learn the language, and I was telling my mom, I went to a grocery store in a kind of nice neighborhood that had a gelato bar. And I remember seeing this little kid who was like 4 or 5 going in and asking for these Italian gelatos with these sort of different names and giving it the Italian pronunciation. I just remember thinking like, it's a weird advantage, but being exposed to these things at a young age because of where you live and your zip code and the education of your parents, that kind of human capital just accrues over time and accumulates. And even if you are a well-meaning college admissions person, you're going to look at someone who has these experiences in this education, it's going to be hard not to advantage that person. And then suddenly the next generation has an advantage in terms of education. And that's, I think, one of the shames of Trump versus Hillary, because I thought Hillary Clinton's actual policies would do much more to improve economic mobility. But Trump sounded like he was more aware of the problem, would actually do more.
And so how do we use this for forecasting going forward? Because at this stage, I basically look at things and say, I don't see a lot happening with the current administration. I don't see a lot happening in the legislative process. And so one of the main things I'm interested in right now are midterm elections, mm-hmm. and will an impeachment, you know, happen soon? Because before midterm elections,
right.
One of the things that was mentioned repeatedly was that Robert Mueller is continuing to investigate. One thing we haven't mentioned was Comey said, I think you've something to the effect of, it's almost certain that Trump is under investigation at this point. And and that Mueller is dogged and that he also has the power to prosecute. Right. Because the role of the FBI is to investigate. They don't prosecute. They gather the evidence. They give this evidence to the attorneys and then the U.S. attorneys, and then they decide, can we make a case and do we go forward with it? Yeah. And right now, Jeff Sessions appears to have his own set of problems, and so the Department of Justice, let's say, may be suspect, but Mueller can go around that. He doesn't need to use them. So there's both the sort of legal issue of, you know, will there be a strong enough case made? There's the political issue among the extreme elites, meaning Congress. So right. will Congress at some point say, yeah, there's so much evidence brought here that even though this guy may be from our party, I need to step in because this is not working. And then there's the third level, which would be, will the general population, if the Congress doesn't move, will the general population reach a point where they say, you know, yeah, we're going to throw out a lot of people right. in the midterm elections, and it'll become very, very painful for them to stay with Trump. And I think at the current stage, I was actually surprised that I think it's now something like 40% think that he will not make it, that Trump won't make it through his first term.
Yeah, and I'm skeptical of that, but I get it.
So skeptical, you think he will or won't?
I think he will. I think it's, okay. Like, you know, as I said earlier, I think at this point, the Republican Party, which currently controls both houses of Congress, Trump is, he is like a, let's just say, he is like something that all they need is a hand, basically. All they need is a hand that can sign bills, and they're willing to put up with almost anything else.
So then I want to get back to a question that you said earlier, or a comment you made earlier in this podcast, which was that, is this a week that we will look back at this moment in time, so Comey's testimony, and say this was a pivotal point? If it doesn't lead towards sort of a sea change, how can it be a pivotal point?
So I think that, and we'll talk about this in more depth in our next podcast, where we talk sort of about the models for understanding the Trump administration, because that's those models, some of the ones that I want to talk about, I want to talk about them in the context of where I think things could go. But one of the things, I've talked about this before, when I say I'm concerned about Trump discovering his pardon power, because the pardon power doesn't have a lot of limits. And once he starts to use it, I think things could go off the rails quickly. I think that one of the lessons that I think I've learned, but one of the things that I'm sort of starting to understand is, given the reluctance of people on the right to restrain Trump and this desire for people who want their policies enacted, Paul Ryan, who seems thirsty for any bill and is willing to apologize for almost anything that Trump does in order to get this bill signed, if they're not willing to check him, right, he's not going to be able to get a lot of stuff done through the legislature, which is apparent. He has talked about how he would very much like to get rid of the legislative filibuster in the Senate, even though no senator seems to be taking. Oh, actually, that's not true. There have been a few senators who have said either, yeah, that might be a thing, or they have suggested changing the rules of that the Senate parliamentarian has, the power the Senate parliamentarian has over their legislation, so that instead of having to deal with all these different rules when it comes to reconciliation for passing legislation, maybe they sort of do some end run around that so they can pass bills with a simple majority vote. But leaving that aside, I think that we may find, I guess my concern is, Trump may flex his executive power wings. He may say, I can't get a lot of stuff done through the legislature. I'm going to explore what I can do unilaterally as an executive, because he hasn't. And the two things that he can do are military action. And there are a few things. The two things I'm worried about are military action and the pardon power. I mean, he could pardon Flynn now. He could end the...
But what does this do? So
there's no investigation. Okay. He could stop the investigation now. He could pardon Flynn now.
No, no, no.
Yes, he could. Yes, of course he could.
I'm saying something else. So sure, he can pardon Flynn, and Flynn doesn't go to jail. Yeah, fine. That doesn't stop Mueller from continuing his investigation, as far as I know.
So Mueller can be fired at any time by the Attorney General, right?
Correct. If Mueller is fired, it's over.
Oh, I disagree. We have seen the Republicans apologize, make excuses for everything Trump has done.
The Republicans did not attack Comey at all today on his credibility. I mean, almost no. I shouldn't say not at all.
There was a little bit. You're right. They're really
little,
different.
Very little.
Yeah.
And Mueller is also supposedly having a view that he is truly above the fray, and he has a history of this. And I think when you speak about Republicans, you're not. It's not right to look at them as a monolith. So yeah, there is a group of. There's some truly diehard group of Gore supporters that it doesn't matter what Trump does, but that is not that's not even near half of the Republicans.
Oh,
and I don't think so. I think
has been this portrait of courage.
Who in Congress has been the portrait of courage?
Who in Congress has been the person who says
McCain until he had his addled moment today, which I don't know whether he was addled or whether he was actually trying to discredit Comey. So he looked truly, truly confused.
Yes,
and for me, it was actually a sad moment because even though I don't ideologically agree with him, I basically do view him as a type of a hero for what he's done throughout his life. And so I thought this is sad. And hopefully he just was having low blood sugar, seriously.
Right.
But in general, okay, I could say that McCain, you know, there's only a few that I can say of right now. But I think that there is a state where just look at Trump's approval ratings. So if Trump's approval rating right now, and this is only based on one poll, and certainly it wasn't a Rasmussen poll, but if they're at 34% before Comey's testimony, and I think if he's seen to fire Mueller, you know, just because he's getting too close, and more information comes out, I don't see how Trump's approval rating would keep dropping even further. Besides that, he can't get anything done. You know, so I think there's a point where he's not passing any legislation. Nothing's getting better. And you have to remember, it's not the choice of, you get rid of Trump and then you're going to have Hillary in, because I think there's still sort of this discussion, which I think is bad on. I simply don't even want to mention the name Hillary. Not out of, you know, any sort of hatred, malice for her, towards her. But I basically think the election's over. So I had a discussion recently with a Romanian American, who started talking about Hillary again. I actually we've had a few conversations recently with people who are basically pro-Trump, and they started bringing up Hillary. And I said, sorry, I'm not talking about that. The election is over. We're not talking about Hillary. We're not talking about her server. It's like, that's done. And what you're talking about now is whether it's Trump or Pence or Trump or whatever. And so it's you're not putting in a Democrat. So at what point do... Totally. I mean, he's done plenty of absurd things, but to totally throw justice out the window.
Oh, I don't know. I think that you can't. So
I think we may find out. That's the sad part. You know, I think we.
No,
you know,
I agree.
Unfortunately, I wish this would just stay a theoretical discussion, a hypothetical discussion. But I think it may at some point, you know, come to that point, like what happened in the Nixon administration.
Yeah, I mean, I could see scenarios. I don't know what the probability would be, but if he said something like, I'm going to pardon Flynn, Manafort, and Jared Kushner, they're good people. They are new to governing. They may have done some stuff that was unorthodox. And just to be safe, I'm going to give them my pardons. But I don't think they did anything. I don't think they acted out of any kind of malice or malevolence or really intent to.
Sure.
And so there's no need for investigation. So thanks, Mueller, you can go now. I've pardoned everybody you're investigating. They may have done some stuff that was technically illegal, but they're acting in the best interest of the country. They're good people, and it's time to move on. I think a lot of Republicans would cover for him if he did something like that.
I think at this stage, I don't think so. I think at this stage, if they said basically these guys aren't going to do jail time, I think there'd still be, including Republicans. I mean, I don't see how the people in the Senate can, in the Senate Intelligence Committee can understand that, because essentially that's to say we don't care at all. If it was just about Flynn went and had a talk and got paid some money for being at a talk in Russia, fine, kind of bad, but if all we saw was what's on the surface, okay, we could tolerate that and said he had bad judgment. But when there's still an open question as to whether they actively colluded with Russia, and that has not been solved, I don't see how you can let that one slide and say I mean, sure, if they found out, they had connections, but those connections were just simply about trying to create good policy towards Syria, you know, see where we have common ground.
Right.
If it, you know, if it comes out to that point and they could be exonerated, where we'd say, yeah, technically they broke the law. Technically they should have, Flynn should have, registered as a lobbyist, whatever, for these foreign powers, but he really wasn't trying to do this, you know, for corporate interests, right, for, you know, subverting the
money,
Obama administration, whatever.
Yeah,
right. Then I think they could actually get away with it, where you'd say, yeah, we pardoned him because it was well-intentioned. But I think the investigation has to proceed to at least find out, was it just that or was it something more sinister? And I think if it stopped before then, you don't have to have half the Republicans. I think that would be a line too far. I think there is a line too far.
I don't know.
Because the other question is there no line at all?
Yeah. You're exactly right. That to me is the question. Where is the line? And I guess I've seen enough behavior to make me think that it's lower than we think. That
I would never thought it had gotten this far. If you asked me 2 or 3 years ago,
no, right,
would America have a president with all this? Yeah, I would have said you're absolutely mad.
Yeah, I think the line could be very, very low. And yeah, the amount of support he'd need to hemorrhage or the things he would need to do have to be worse than what we've seen.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure. But we'll see. This feels like a monumental week.
There's another issue, though, which we haven't gotten into, which is even that he allowed Comey to testify.
Oh, sure.
And we definitely, this will be when we have our discussion on models, mm-hmm, models, not meaning like pretty people, but concepts of how he thinks, what drives him, which is relevant to forecasting.
Sure.
And I think that he could have invoked executive privilege and said, I don't want Comey to testify. What he's going to testify about were private conversations between a president and essentially not counsel, because he said it'd be easier to bring this up with Sally Yates, to say that Sally Yates was actually, you know, have lawyer sort of, it wasn't really attorney-client privilege, but to say something like that was existing between them.
Right.
But in the case of Comey, he still could have said, you know, he was acting, let's say, on behalf of the United States, but these were covered by executive privilege. There's,
right,
this is a question as to whether that would stand legally, but that he didn't even make that fight, to me, goes into, you could say, as a political calculation, but I think it's also a hubris of thinking, I have nothing to hide. I'm fine. I don't like investigations. I wish everybody could be fired that's looking into me, but basically I'm right. Let the guy talk. I'm going to prove that I'm better anyway. I can outsmart this guy. And
maybe, yeah.
I think that for him to stop the investigation of Mueller would be a pretty tough one, because that would be essentially, that's like to admit type of guilt. And that's not something that I think he likes to do. I don't think he can do. I don't think his mentality allows him to do that. His mentality may allow him to pardon somebody after they've, you know, been found, essentially found guilty, or overwhelming evidence is there to say, yeah, okay, they're good patriots, they're good guys, he's my friend. And he may even say it that way, like, yeah, these guys are my friends, they've been loyal, they're loyal to the country. There's no sense in beating him to death on it. But I think he can't bring himself to say he's made mistakes.
All right, so let's close on this. Over under November 1st, 2017, Trump has pardoned at least one person. You think it's after November 1st? You think he pardons at least one person before November 1st?
I think after.
I think maybe before.
You could be right. Oh, I should also give a probability. So not just say, because I could say it's only 51%.
Right.
So if you're to say it's more likely, what percentage would you give it?
It's a good question, because having framed it that way, I'm not sure I want to go over 50%. It's very close. I would say it's very close. I would say maybe you're right. Maybe I say after, but close after. I would say,
or by the end of the year.
I feel like maybe, I would say maybe, I think, 40% chance, maybe 35% chance before November 1st he's pardoned someone. So under 50%. So let me revise what I was. I think I would say about 35% chance before November 1st. And that's close. That's coming up. He's pardoned someone. I'm concerned about him really flexing his unilateral executive powers. And the pardon is a big one. And I think it may happen sooner rather than later, particularly if things start to approach his inner circle. If something happens with Jared Kushner, now part of that is premised on the idea that the the investigation will not take years, and it probably will take years. But assuming something happens quickly, I could see him stepping in and pardoning someone. Let me take it down. I'd say maybe 30, maybe high 20s, 28%. So not above 50%, but it's...
Now you're getting closer to my number, because my number would have been around 20-25%.
I'm talking myself down a little. I don't think it's over 50%, but it's a material number.
Yeah, and sure. I agree. And I'd also say, thankfully, you've done it without my suggestion, because I didn't want to step in and try to lead you.
Yes. We talk things out when we podcast.
Yes, which sometimes is helpful. I mean, literally,
absolutely.
Part of the way we work is that we do work as groups. We don't try to have group think, but right. We do try to, you know, each put out our own ideas and then bat them around.
Yeah, definitely.
And one of the ways we actually work on coming up with forecasts sometimes is we may work for 2 or 3 days where we start to research something, some comments show, but we don't actually see anybody's forecast until we've made our forecast ourselves first, at least put out one forecast, and then so we don't anchor. There's also the idea of a conditional forecast. So conditional would be to say if the investigation is still ongoing and no person has been indicted, you know, basically there's no case brought against anyone yet, will he pardon them? Or if they had been convicted. So, because there's different stages along the way. So you can preemptively pardon and say, I will pardon this person for, you know, anything that they had done in the past, anything that they may be found guilty of in the future that they had done, you know, before this date.
Right.
He could do that. I think that would be unusual. I don't think he may want to squash the, I'm sure he wants to squash the investigation. That's clear. But I think giving the pardon, if the pardon was viewed as for the purpose of squashing the investigation, I think that would be damaging to the point that I'd be surprised if he would do that. Now, if he saw that particularly Jared, but whether it's Jared or even Flynn or Manafort, if he saw that, they're already found guilty, or there's overwhelming evidence, I think they're going to be found guilty. At this stage, I'm going to more or less accept that some bad things went on. The guy is, you know, well-intentioned. Let's give him a pardon.
Right.
He's going to be out of government, but that's it. I could see that happening. That wouldn't surprise me. I just don't think I don't think things are going to progress that far. Or if they do, I think that if something happens in the next few months, it would basically be that he's heading out of office, in which case, until he would truly be heading out of office, I don't see him doing the pardons.
Sure.
Because I think he'd be consumed. I mean, Nixon, I mean, and once again, these are sort of like weird base rates to look at. But as far as I understand, Nixon fired a lot of people, but Nixon wasn't pulling out his pardon pin, pardoning all the people around him. Now, Nixon doesn't have the same psychology as Trump.
Correct. But, weird to say, but yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Different animals. We'll see. It'll be interesting to see. Okay. Anyway, that's nonprofits. We will, at some point, we're going to get our Twitter account active. I want to start tweeting. But until then.
Tweets just scare me now. So I don't know. I don't think it's helped our country.
We will let the listeners know. And then we can have some back and forth. Until then.
And we'll start doing podcasts that are only 140 characters long.
Yep. Trump? ? Frowny face. Yeah, but until
like,
then,
like ice cream.
Yes, that's what all of our tweets are going to be like. That we're just going to be fishing for compliments. It's going to be me in a bathing suit.
Covfefe.
We didn't even talk about covfefe.
We didn't even get to covfefe, and we're already
We'll save covfefe because that could be a tough podcast. That's bizarre. Anyway, just bizarre. And Sean Spicer coming out. And again, we're not going to talk about this. But Sean Spicer coming out the next day and suggesting. Oh, it was an
we know what it means.
It was an inside joke. Yeah. Give me a break. Yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Anyway, we will discuss that another time. But until we have our Twitter account active, nonprofitspod.wordpress.com. You can also email us nonprofitspod@gmail.com. And we'll be back I think probably next week. I think Robert might be back next week. If not, we'll get on.
Sounds good.
And we'll talk about some of the news. All right. Bye bye.
Bye bye.